This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It is so wonderful to be here with you today. I'm truly humbled and honored to be here today, continuing a tradition at the Stein Institute that has been ongoing for over 40 years. Over those 40 years, this community public lecture has had the most amazing and esteemed speakers. And for more than a decade, I've had the opportunity and the privilege to lead this lecture, to organize the speakers and moderate the Q&A. And so I must say that I am deeply humbled and honored to have the opportunity to join this esteemed group as one of your speakers. I must note that one thing that's a little bit different is that I'm a social worker by training, which means that my experience is a little different than what you've been used to. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that I'm the first social worker to ever present at this public lecture series in 40 years. So it really is an honor to be here today to be able to share this knowledge with you. So because I'm not a researcher, it means that my experience today is going to be more clinically driven. So my work in grief and loss as a clinical therapist is going to be highlighted here. And I, of course, will be using research to bring that all in today. So given I'm not a researcher, my talk will be more clinically focused, and I hope that you find that valuable. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. So I want to start a little bit with something personal. So I've spent over a decade working in the fields of grief, loss, and resilience, and I've learned an extraordinary amount through that time. From research that I've learned and had the opportunity to participate in, to clients that I've worked with, and the amazing colleagues that I've had the opportunity to train under. But without question, the most profound understanding that I have of grief didn't come from my training at all. It came from my own personal experience of loss. So in 2006, when I was in graduate school, training to become a social worker of all things, I lost my brother Brian tragically and suddenly to suicide. It was a tragic, sudden, and life-altering event. To say that it was devastating would be a massive understatement. It was the moment that split my life into two parts. It was everything that happened before we lost Brian, and then my life after we lost Brian. Grief changed me. It shaped how I understand suffering and healing and what it means to rebuild a life. It taught me what no textbook ever could, and that is what pain is like, what deep suffering is like, but also about strength, vulnerability, and meaning. So while my work is grounded in evidence and clinical experience, it's also deeply personal. It's one that I always continue to be able to honor my brother Brian's life and ensure that his impact lives on. So from that place, both professional and personal, I speak to you today. So I wanted to start with this quote, "There is no grief like the grief that doesn't speak." This was a quote I stumbled upon very early in my own grief journey. And at the time, it was something that helped me put words to something I wasn't able to name. That unspoken grief, the kind that you carry silently, that can feel the heaviest. And now as a clinician, it resonates differently, but just as powerfully. I see how many people carry their grief and don't feel permission to express it, and how important it is to create space for grief and be heard however we show up. What I've learned in grief, both in my own personal and professional experience, is that we don't grieve well alone. And so giving grief a voice is where resilience begins. And I feel deeply honored and called to do this work. Because while many people see grief work as heavy or dark, many people will say to me, "How do you do that work? It sounds so depressing, so difficult." I see it as profoundly hopeful. Being able to walk alongside someone during their grief journey, to witness their strength, their courage, but also bear witness to their suffering and be alongside them during their rediscovery is something that is extremely meaningful and incredibly powerful and human. So for those of you that are here today because you're grieving, I want you to know that there's hope. My hope is that this talk provides even a small sense of that hope for you, and that the healing is possible and that you're not alone. So I have a lot to cover today. Here's my agenda for today. We're going to talk about acute grief and integrated grief, and then I'm going to move into talking to you about what prolonged grief disorder is and its treatment. We're going to talk about the science of resilience. What are the key concepts there and how does that inform adaptation to loss? And then we're going to talk about some practical strategies that you can use to enhance resilience in grief and also help others in your life who might be struggling. So let's start at the very beginning. Grief. What is it? Grief is universal, right? If we live long enough, sadly, we'll all experience grief of the loss of someone we love. So while it's universal, how we understand it is not so universal. So if you just do a quick Google search, you'll see that there are all shapes and sizes in how people see grief, understand grief, experience grief, stages of grief. It really can be daunting and confusing and overwhelming. So for purposes of today, and also just for you to think about grief, we're going to keep it pretty simple. Grief is a response to loss. Very simple, right? And so what I want you to understand about grief, and some of you are probably all too familiar with this, is that it's complex. It's a really complicated, complex experience. And it's the form that love takes when we lose someone we love. It's permanent after we lose someone. It's ever evolving and changing. So one thing I want you to understand is grief is not something to be resolved or to get rid of. Grief is something to learn how to live with, manage, and adapt to. So as a grief therapist, I always tell people, our job is to not get rid of your grief. Not at all. Grief is lifelong. And in fact, I'm nearly 20 years since my loss. And sometimes I grieve just intensely today as I did month one of losing my brother. So it's ever changing and ever evolving though. It's universal, right? Again, if we live long enough, we'll all experience it on some level. And yet it has recognizable but differentiating features. So I think about grief as a thumbprint. There are no two that are exactly the same, but there are a lot of similar themes and things that look comparable, right? So it's unique to all of us. There are as many different ways to grieve as there are people grieving, but yet there's a lot of commonalities and similarities. So while I can't begin to understand somebody's grief and what their grief is like, I have a deep understanding of what grief is like because I've lived through it myself. And another thing to think about is that it naturally contains mixed feelings and thoughts. It might contain anger. It might contain pleasant emotions. It might contain suffering and disbelief and denial and sort of all kinds of mixed emotions. And it is ever changing. And that is one of the reasons why grief can be so difficult to manage at first, because it is so confusing. And nothing can prepare us for the complexity and the challenges and the myriad of emotions that come up until we walk through that door ourselves. And then on top of that, on top of grief being this complex, difficult experience, it's also a stress response. The loss of someone close brings some of the biggest, most difficult stressors that we can face, and many challenges that we can face as well. So this is all added onto the challenges that we're dealing with as we're struggling with somebody that we've lost. So I want you to think of it sort of in these two different buckets. So there's the range of stressful losses, and then there's orientation, restoration related stressors that we have too. So when we think about the stressful losses that can occur, it's coping with loss of companionship. I've lost my person. I no longer have that person. Like when I get on a plane, I text that person I'm taking off. When I get off the plane, I text that person I'm getting off. I don't have my person. The person who picks me up from the airport at LAX during traffic. So it's the loss of companionship in that person that you hold dear. The sense of protection. So when we're in a really close attached relationship, that relationship can provide us with safety and security, a safe haven, a secure base, a loss of our sense of self. Who am I without this person? I don't know who I am. I have been part of this unit for all these years. I've been married for 30 years, 40 years. Who am I without that partnership? Or maybe I have been a mother to this beautiful child and I've lost my child. Who am I now without that child? This can be such a disorienting sense of self for people who are struggling with a loss. It can also impact aspects of our personal and social identity. So maybe if we have lost a child, we're no longer welcomed at, or no longer feel welcomed at functions that our kids and parents are hosting. Maybe if we're part of a couple, we no longer feel like we fit in and we feel the third wheel at like dinners and dinner parties and whatnot. It also can impact our sense of stability. And if we were a caregiver, it can impact that caregiver role, right? So this sort of type of meaning and security we got in helping somebody we loved and caring for them, and now we've lost that role. So who am I now without that? But it also can impact other restoration related things as well. So changing family dynamics, exclusion from social groups, difficulty meeting our responsibilities, maybe paying bills, and an increased uncertainty about the future. So let's start with attachment theory. So this really is at the heart of how we see grief and loss. And it's founded by the father of attachment theory, John Bowlby. And he helped us sort of understand why loss can feel so devastating. So when I think about attachments, I think about how we are just naturally hardwired to seek proximity to others, right? We are hardwired to maintain close relationships to people biologically. And so when we have close attachment figures in our life, they become part of our internal physiology. So our internal homeostasis is relegated on us having that attachment. So when we lose that attachment figure to death, or even a breakup, but if we lose attachment figure to death, you can imagine our whole internal world becomes disrupted. Our physiology and internal homeostasis is completely disrupted. And this is why people will be so confused about what's happening to them during the initial months after a loss, because we'll have difficulty eating, sleeping, focusing, concentrating. There's a term called grief brain, which is our inability to like process information that we normally can. So there becomes all of these challenges that happen when our attachment is lost. And so we have to find a new way to sort of influence this internal world and adapt to this new world without our loved one in it. So in essence, Bowlby is sort of helping us remember the importance of these attachment figures and why it can be so devastating to lose them, because it's a reflection of love and the powerful bonds that we have as human beings when we connect and have meaningful relationships in our life. And again, it goes back to the price that we pay for love. So let's talk about the stages of grief. So many of you have probably heard about Dr. Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, which include things like denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. So what we know about this is that grief is not linear. And I'm going to show you some research about that in just a little bit. So it is not, does not happen in any progressive way. It's not linear. It doesn't happen in stage, like you meet this stage and you move to the next stage. Quite the contrary. It can feel messy. It can feel up, down, left, right. It can feel like, oh, I have this. And then the next minute, oh my God, I'm crying in the grocery store. I cannot do groceries without thinking about the things I used to buy, my husband or my wife. So it really is not linear. But these stages really can be helpful for us to think about some of the common themes that can that grievers can struggle with or challenged. So it's not unusual for people to have denial or anger or bargaining or depression or acceptance, right? So we might see all of these things, just mine is going to be packaged very differently than yours is going to be packaged. And maybe you're never going to struggle with anger, but maybe I'm going to. So these are just things to keep in mind, but they're certainly not things you should think about when you're grieving and saying like, well, why isn't mine going in this nice progressive order? It doesn't go like that. So the reality is these stages can happen at any time and in any order because grief is not linear. And it's important to remember that. So let's get into some of the ways that we see grief. Grief does not go away completely, but it does change over time, like I said. And so when we think about sort of the grieving process and the mourning process, right after we lose someone that we love, we enter into what we call the acute phase of grief. So the acute phase of grief would be this initial form of grief that is often intense, dominates the mind of a bereaved person. This is the where we're like difficulty going to work. We are difficult eating, sleeping, focusing, concentrating. Perhaps we're in the height of denial or sort of numb as we're going through the funeral process or they're making arrangements, we can feel very detached and numb. So this is where we see acute grief. And this would be in the initial months following the loss. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 months after the loss is what we see as acute grief. And then in time, and no exact time, but in time, we hope to, and most of us move into what we call integrated grief. So this is a quieter form of grief. This is a place where the loved one still lives within us. But I like to say, like, the sharp edges of grief. So if we think about grief as like living in this box of us, all of the sharp edges that used to like really dig into us every time we'd think about our loved one, they start to dull a little bit. And now they become a little bit more manageable, more quiet. So the grief is still there. It's accessible, but it's not dominating our mind, and we're able to regain our capacity to engage in life and feel connected to the world around us again. But what happens when that doesn't happen? So that we can move into what we call prolonged grief. So prolonged grief is a form of grief that's more persistent and intense and preoccupying and impairs functioning for far longer than what we would expect. And what we actually see with prolonged grief is that those who struggle with prolonged grief do not work with the old adage, time heals all wounds, right? When we think about that, like, oh, time heals all wounds. Yes, that's lovely. But for those who are dealing with prolonged grief, it's actually the opposite. As time goes on, their grief intensifies. Life becomes harder. They become more disconnected from their family or friends. Maybe their family and friends are getting frustrated and annoyed and have just like, don't understand what's happening. And so they withdraw even more because people don't understand them. And so this can go on indefinitely. And in fact, in my time as a grief therapist, I've worked with people who sadly are 10, 15, and up to 20 years since the loss, and they are grieving just as intensely as the first month. So that's what we call prolonged grief. So when we think about grieving as well, as we're sort of moving through the acute phase of grief, the thoughts and feelings can be mixed, and they can occur naturally. So we can sort of have this back and forth tug of war between two differing ideas. So for example, when we think about the experience of grief, we might want the grief to go away. Like, oh, this is so painful. This is so painful. I don't want to feel this way anymore. But also feeling like I really want to hold on to this grief. This grief is still like what I have left of my loved one, and I don't want to let that go. Or maybe we want to be free of the pain and the suffering, but think that we should suffer forever. What would it say about me if I wasn't still suffering? I've seen people who are parents and they feel convinced that what would it say about me as a mother if I wasn't suffering anymore? It would mean that I didn't love my child as much as I really could have. And I don't want to have that statement about myself. So there's this sort of tug of war, push pull between, I don't want to feel this pain, but if I let go of this pain, what would that mean about me? So wanting to sort of move on, and that's a term I don't like to use a lot, but people do, wanting to move on with life, but also feeling like we want to keep things exactly the way it is. Feeling a need to be with other people, but also feeling like I can't connect with people. I need to pull away from people. Oh my God, the people keep calling me, keep texting me. I don't have it in me to even respond. Knowing loss is real, but also having a difficult time understanding it. So for example, I think about grief work as like helping our intellectual mind meet with where our emotional mind is. So our intellectual mind knows that our loved one is gone, but our emotional mind cannot come to terms with that at all. And so there'll be this tug of war between what our intellectual mind knows and our emotional mind does not want to know. So maybe we crave closeness to the person we lost, but also feel too much pain when we look at photos and memories. So you can see how confusing this could be for a griever. It's like these two like diametrically different ideas and thoughts that can exist in the frame of 10 seconds. So it can really be something that we can struggle with. So what does adapting to loss look like? So it's changing our expectations of automatic behaviors to fit a change in new world. And so many of us in the grief world think about adaptational loss as a learning experience. It's something that we're trying to learn and re-experience in the new world, right? So we're trying to A, accept the reality of the loss and restore the capacity for well-being. We're trying to do these two things at once. So we're trying to accept the reality, which is the most painful thing. For those of us grieving, accepting the reality of something that we absolutely do not want to be true is so terribly painful that we will do anything to avoid that and thinking about that. Avoiding the finality of the loss and the permanence. We want to think about a changed relationship to the person. But we also need to find a way to restore capacity for well-being again, right? So we need to be able to sort of adapt to this new reality and accept all that it means, but also find a way to re-engage in our life. We can't just do one. Adapting to loss needs to have both. So we want to think about possibilities for purpose and meaning, joy and satisfaction, a sense of competence, like, oh, I wasn't able to do these things before, but now I can. I never had to pay those bills before on my own, but look at me, now I can. And the promise of satisfying and meaningful relationships. These are really key as well. So when we accept the reality and restore our capacity to thrive, grief becomes integrated. It finds a place to live in our life, and the physiology can become re-regulated. And so I think one of the key things that I can give, like if people ask me for a tip as a grief therapist, like what is some one thing that can help me adapt to my loss? I think about the dual process model. And really the dual process model is about an oscillation between touching the grief and putting it away and restoring your capacity to engage in life. So it's rather than a linear process that the stages of grief gave us, the dual process model allows for a back and forth. And so whether you are grieving the loss of someone you love or dealing with a really stressful life event or something that's really hard, this is a key part of resilience. And I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. The dual process model allows us to like touch that stuff and then totally put it away. And people will say to me, well, that just sounds like a distraction and distractions don't sound healthy. I'll say, no, it's actually the opposite. Don't use the word distraction, use the word restoration. I am trying to restore myself so that I can go back to that painful thing again. So this back and forth really is a helpful way to cope and adapt to a loss. Okay, so grief in older adults. Let's take a moment to take a step back and sort of look at the broad impact that grief in older adults can have. So this is a table that summarizes how grief is not just an emotional experience, which we all know it's not just emotional. It's a whole person experience, right? So it touches physical, cognitive, and psychological domains. So grief in older adults, we know that by and large, most older adults are resilient and find a way to adapt to challenges in their life, including a loss, right? But for a percentage of older adults, grief can actually be quite difficult and impactful. It can impact our physical health. So it can cause increased infection, stress immune imbalance, and higher mortality. So I'm sure many of you have heard of this widowhood effect, which is that there's a higher likelihood of a partner passing within 3 to 6 months after a long-term relationship. Mental health, 1 in 5 can experience prolonged grief. And 30% can experience depression and loneliness. And cognition, so attention, memory decline, these can be reversible, but they are something that can be quite scary in the initial phases. And so the resilience factors that we want to think about with older adults include like, you know, enhancing psychological strength, social engagement, meaning making, and therapeutic interventions if necessary. So grieving caregivers is also another area that we see a lot, right? So many of us, many of you are probably caregivers. And so caregivers are struggling with various forms of grief, including ambiguous grief and anticipatory grief. So anticipatory grief is the grief that we have when we're feeling that the loss is happening, but it's still some ways away. But anticipatory grief doesn't equal preparation. So it's just this knowing that something's happening, we're losing our loved one minute by minute, but it's still, they're still here. I still know they're here. And ambiguous grief is a type of grief that we have, like with a person with dementia or Alzheimer's, they might be sort of emotionally there, but we still haven't quite like come to terms with that reality with them yet. Now let's move into prolonged grief disorder and its treatment. So let's start with this grief infographic. It's a nice way to be able to illustrate what acute grief integrated grief looks like and what happens when it doesn't move into integrated grief. So we think about a loss, we start with bereavement, and then we move into the state of acute grief, right? So this is something we've already talked about today. This is that heightened state of grieving, immediately following the loss. And then many times we'll move down into what we call defense mechanisms or pause points. These are when our grief sort of gets a little bit of a distance from our emotions. So maybe we feel numb or have some magical thinking where we sort of believe that our loved one might come back into the house at any moment. These serve as an opportunity for us to get a little bit of distance from that intense grief in the initial days. But by and large, eventually it moves into what we call adapting, accepting the reality, and restoring capacity to fly, to thrive. And then it moves into what we call integrated grief. But what happens for those who do not move into integrated grief? So these stuck points that become natural eventually turn into derailers. So if you think about the grieving process as a train track, right? So the grieving process, your train is going down through the mourning process, but something along the way has got that train derailed. And so that train goes off the track and stays indefinitely derailed in this acute state of grieving. And so people can stay there 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. I have treated people 20 years since the loss. And so we have got to figure out how to help clients get off of that derailed state, back on track, and moving them through the mourning process. And so what does prolonged grief disorder look like? Well, it's actually not a completely different way of grieving. It's not all that different than the acute phases of grief, right? High intensity grief. We are aching, we are suffering, we are longing, we are yearning. We've had these defensive coping that persist and have excessive influence on our mental functioning. So our ability to sort of get back into the world and engage in our life in a meaningful way. And adaptation, that point that I showed you earlier, is prevented. And so we something that is getting in the way of our ability to move through that grieving process. And so really, it's a continuation of natural grief long beyond the time limits. So if we think about you, generally, people start to integrate the losses between 1-2 years after a loss, but this can persist long term and indefinitely. And so in order to treat this, we've got to remove the impediments that have gotten people derailed and facilitate adaptation. So what does prolonged grief disorder look like? So those of you at home who maybe are struggling with this intense form of grieving or have friends or family that you think might have prolonged grief disorder, let's go through what the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM, says for diagnosing prolonged grief. So first you have to look at it's got to be the death of a person close to us at least 12 months since the loss. We're looking for a persistent, pervasive yearning, longing, or preoccupation with their loved one that's died. And since the death, there's been at least three of the following in a significantly clinical degree and nearly every day for the past month. So we're looking for things like disrupted identity, marked sense of disbelief, avoidance of reminders. So really trying to avoid reminders of things that connect you to your loved one, intense emotional pain, difficulty engaging in your life in a meaningful way, emotional numbness. Maybe you've totally detached from your feelings, feeling that life is meaningless, or intense loneliness. And so we're also looking for significant distress and impairment in personal, family, educational, social, occupational, or important other areas of functioning. And a really important piece that we want to think about is duration and severity clearly exceed expected norms in the individual's social, cultural, and religious contexts. So risk factors. Why do some people develop prolonged grief while others don't? We don't exactly know why, but we do know that there are some things that are risk factors for developing prolonged grief. So let's look at some of those. So individual variables would include history of depression, prior losses or trauma, age. So people over 65 have a higher likelihood of developing prolonged grief, difficult relationships with early attachments, and then the relationship to the person who died, the closeness and how they were defined in our identity, secure relationships, and people who are caregivers of someone with Alzheimer's and dementia are more likely to develop prolonged grief. We also are looking at the circumstances around the death. So we know that the age that someone died, so if they're younger, how they died. So people who have lost someone by suicide, homicide, or violent death are also more likely to develop prolonged grief. and the context. So what is going on in the bereaved person's life? Have they lost income? Have they had to move? Have they had all losses of social connections, changes in their lifestyle? So these are all a number of things that can impact whether or not we will develop prolonged grief. And then I want to talk a little bit about caregivers in prolonged grief, because my guess is many of you who are watching today in the Stein Institute community are caregivers or know somebody that's a caregiver. So while many family members show remarkable resilience after the loss of a loved one, caregiving, particularly for someone who has Alzheimer's or dementia, can leave lasting emotional impacts. So studies have shown that caregivers of individuals with dementia are at a higher risk of developing prolonged grief. In fact, approximately 10 to 20% of bereaved dementia caregivers are affected by prolonged grief disorder. Now, at first glance, 20% might not sound like a large number, but when we consider how many people are caregivers for someone with dementia or Alzheimer's, and how many of them lose a loved one each year, that number quickly adds up. So let's put this in perspective. In the United States alone, there are millions of dementia caregivers. If even 20% of those experience a loss, go on to develop prolonged grief disorder, we're talking hundreds of thousands of individuals who may be silently struggling with persistent and impairing grief. And that's why it's so important to recognize the emotional toll that caregivers have and get them the help that they need while they are caregiving. So let's look at a few of those factors that might increase the risk of caregivers developing prolonged grief. So number one, big risk, being married to the person who died. This really puts us at risk, especially if it was a long-lasting relationship. Number two, if you derived benefit from caregiving, so maybe you found great meaning in helping your loved one and taking care of them, and that really became part of your identity, and now you've lost that meaningful role. Perhaps you've had compromised physical and mental health before the loss and after the loss. Perhaps it's the trauma of witnessing long-term dying process, how difficult that can be on a loved one, and also feeling not prepared for the loss. So while we think about people who have been caring for someone with Alzheimer's and dementia as being a long sort of runway where you have perhaps time to prepare, that's actually not the case. So that doesn't equal preparedness. So we really want to help people think about the things that might factor into helping them prepare for a loss during the months and years that they're caregiving for their loved one. So how do we treat prolonged grief disorder? Well, I am just honored to share a little bit about the work that I have done as a prolonged grief disorder therapist. And this is through the Center for Prolonged Grief. Dr. Kathy Scheer at Columbia University has been researching this therapy for well over 30 years. And I have had a great honor of being a prolonged grief disorder therapist for over 10. So prolonged grief disorder therapy is a highly effective form of therapy. It's a 16-session manualized treatment that's designed around six healing milestones that are introduced sequentially, and each one is associated with a specific procedure. And there are these themes and milestones that help us work with our clients to achieve their goals, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about those. So we work with the healing milestones as a way to facilitate adaptation. Because if you remember, what we said was that the grieving process has gotten derailed, right? And so something has gotten the client stuck and on the side of the track spinning. And so we want to help facilitate that piece that's stuck, get them back on track, and move them through the process. And this is how we do that. So number one, we want to work with our clients to help them accept their grief and manage their difficult emotions. And let me tell you, that is one of the most difficult things for grievers, because until you've experienced your own loss, nothing prepares you for the magnitude and the intensity of the feelings that come up when we lose someone we love. So one thing we want to do in prolonged grief is help our clients learn to manage and accept those emotions. Number two, we want to help them see a promising future. So as you can imagine, for many of us who have lost someone, the future seems so dark and black and white without our loved one. And so we want to help our clients re-engage and see a promising future in their life. We want to help them strengthen relationships. So it's not unusual for us to detach from people, to feel disconnected, and maybe have pushed people out of our lives, either because we feel as though they don't understand us, or maybe we are struggling with connection after our loss, and it just doesn't feel like something we have the energy to engage in anymore. So strengthening relationships is another key piece. We're also going to help our clients learn to narrate the story of the death. So when we think about the loss of someone we hold dear, the moment we learn that they died is the moment that everything in our life changed. I know I spoke about this at the beginning of this talk about how the moment my brother died split my life into two pieces, before the loss and after the loss. And so when we think about when did that moment happen, it was the moment I learned my brother had died. And so what we want to do in Prolonged Grief is have our clients tell that story, the moment they learned their loved one died, and have them tell it repeatedly. Now, we know that sounds really difficult and impossible, but what we're trying to do there is help our clients face the reality of the loss and all that it means. And so what that looks like is sort of taking something that feels so unthinkable. The moment we learned our loved one died is so unthinkable. So by helping our clients go back and forth and telling the story of the moment they learned and then putting it away back and forth, we are helping them take the unthinkable and make it thinkable. We're not helping them come to a place where that story is okay with them. We're just helping them learn to tolerate it and face the reality and all that it means. Now, we're also going to help our clients learn to live with reminders. So this is a really hard part of grieving, right? Because we have memories, anniversaries, holidays. We drive by places that remind us of our loved one. We hear music that reminds us of our loved one. There are so many landmines in our life, and it can be so difficult for a griever to re-engage with life after they've lost someone and have to work around all of those reminders. So we're going to help our clients sort of bit by bit, little by little, be able to start connecting to the things they've been avoiding and learn to live with those reminders. And then finally, we're going to help people connect to memories of the person who died, which is another really important piece, because when we can connect to those memories, it helps open up our connection to the person that we lost and help us find a new way to have a relationship with them that is different, but also has an opportunity to grow. So what do we know about prolonged grief disorder therapy and its treatment? So research on prolonged grief disorder therapy has shown really promising results. So I can tell you anecdotally, as a prolonged grief disorder therapist, this therapy is highly effective. I have seen it transform countless lives. But this slide summarizes the findings from three studies, NIMH-funded studies, that include 641 participants, age ranges from 20 to 93, and they were all bereaved by a range of losses, including natural and violent causes. And many of them have tried grief counseling and did not find it helpful. So what this slide shows us is how effective prolonged grief disorder therapy is compared to a control group. So you see here, 71% of those 641 had improvements that were based on prolonged grief disorder therapy, compared to 44%. So what that tells us is this therapy is highly clinically effective and can really make a difference in people's lives. So now let's move to the science of resilience. We're going to cover key concepts and how it can facilitate adaptation to loss. So let's start with the definition. What is resilience? So the American Psychological Association defines resilience as the process of adapting well in the face of adversity, trauma, tragedy, threats, or significant sources of stress, like family and relationship problems, serious health problems, or workplace and financial stressors. So it's not the absence of challenges. It's not that people who have resilience have no access to challenges or problems in their life. Quite the contrary. Resilience is really about our ability to bounce back in the face of these challenges. Let's look at the core components of resilience. So there are four domains: emotion regulation, cognitive flexibility, social support, and meaning making. They're all well established in resilience literature, and they aren't specific to grief alone. In fact, they're considered foundational to how people adapt to all kinds of adversity, whether that's trauma, illness, or major life transitions. But they become especially important when we're grieving, because loss touches every one of these areas in a profound way. So when we talk about resilience, there are several key components that help people to adapt and cope through adversity. So let's go through each one of these in detail. So first is emotion regulation. This is our ability to manage our feelings effectively without becoming too overwhelmed, right? So really our ability to sort of think about our emotions and manage them without going sort of guardrail to guardrail or sort of having these big emotional swings. It's about staying grounded with our emotions when they run high. So that doesn't mean we don't have really strong, intense emotions. It's that we can manage and regulate those emotions when they happen. So next is cognitive flexibility, which is crucial. This means being able to reframe negative thoughts and see challenges from different perspectives, which opens the door to new solutions and hope. So when I think about grieving and I work with some of my clients, what I see is cognitive inflexibility. So it's not unusual for us to get really stuck in rigid thinking. We have specific thoughts about the loss or specific ways that we see pieces of the loss that can be quite rigid. And those rigid ways of seeing things are part of what keeps us stuck. And so having some cognitive flexibility in that and our ability to maybe see things through a wider lens can really be helpful in adapting to loss. Social support. I cannot say enough about the important role that social support plays in resilience. Having strong, reliable relationships provides encouragement, practical help, and a sense of belonging during difficult times. And finally, meaning making. This is a part that connects us to our values. So are we connected to value-driven activities, finding purpose and understanding tough experiences? This can help transform our pain into growth and resilience. So together, all of these factors contribute to building a stronger capacity to bounce back from challenges. So why does resilience matter? I love this slide. So when we first started looking into resilience at the Stein Institute about 10 years ago, I was shocked to find out that there are so many benefits to being resilient. So we started to look at the literature, and I had been working in aging for well over 10 years at this point, and all of this was new to me too. So what we found out was people with resilience have higher psychological outcomes, so lower depression, lower anxiety. I also found out that they have greater social support, gratitude, and spirituality. People who are resilient have stronger immune systems. Isn't that incredible? They also have longer life expectancy, which is fascinating to me. People who are resilient have stronger social ties, are better prepared for life's unpredictability, and have lower high-risk behaviors like substance abuse, gambling, and overeating. So as you can imagine, it can be really important for all of us to enhance our resilience when we think about all of these components that really play a role in our overall health and well-being. I want to spend a moment talking about something central to this talk, which is the idea that resilience is a skill, not just a trait. And this is what I love so much about resilience work, is that there's so much hope in it. It's not something you either have or don't have. Resilience is dynamic. It shifts over time, and depending on our life experiences, the support around us, and the choices we make, it can grow in time. So it's helpful to think about resilience like a muscle. It's not fixed, and it can absolutely grow with practice. So just as we wouldn't expect someone to lift weights without training, we shouldn't expect ourselves or others to bounce back from hardship without support and intentional effort. So with that comes that resilience is dynamic, not fixed. Small actions like reflection, self-care, connection, gratitude practice, adapting our capacity to thrive. All of these things can be enhanced on a daily basis. Routine, goal setting, social ties. These are really things that we can put some intention behind, which can help grow that resilience muscle. Also, I cannot say enough about engaging in value-driven activities. So when we connect to the things that make us us, so when we connect to the things that are most important to who we are, it increases our resilience muscle and our capacity to thrive. So this is an empowering message. We are not just born with a fixed amount of resilience. We can nurture it, shape it, grow it throughout our lives. So let's talk for a moment about the seven C's of resilience. This is a helpful framework for understanding resilience, especially in the context of grief. So the seven C's of resilience was developed by Ken Ginsberg, and it was originally designed actually to support youth development. But these principles have been applied throughout the lifespan, including in the face of deep personal loss. So let me walk you through some of these and how they might relate to grief. So number one, competence. Grief can shake our confidence and make us doubt our ability to function and cope. It can really rattle us to our core. So supporting someone's competence means reminding them that we can and can still do things, even the small things, and helping them rebuild a sense of capacity one step at a time. So confidence. Loss can create self-doubt. Am I grieving right? Will this ever be okay? Competence grows when we have people around us that affirm our experiences and remind us that we are strong, because feeling and connecting to healing is something that is that needs to be nurtured. Connection, we've talked a lot about this, but grief can be incredibly isolating. I think so much about how we carry this grief alone, and we can feel so misunderstood. We can go into a room and we think, how is everybody acting like life is just going on as usual? And I am struggling with this big weight of grief and nobody around me can understand me. So connection is really important. Connection to our community, connection to ourselves, connection to our loved ones, getting back to doing some things that we once enjoyed. Character. Grief often brings moral and existential questions. Why them? Why me? Why now? So supporting character means affirming our own values, identity, and integrity, and helping people stay grounded. And contribution. Sometimes healing comes through doing. So finding ways to give back, whether it's volunteering, creating a legacy project. For me, very shortly after my loss, I took a training program in how to run support groups for suicide loss survivors, and I found that that gave me a great sense of purpose and connection and meaning and contribution, and that really was transformative in my own grief journey. Coping, grief is unpredictable, and it requires tools to navigate those wide swings. So healthy coping could look like anything from journaling, body movement, rituals, or just finding like very slow senses of normalcy again, where we can sort of get back to step-by-step engagement in our lives, whether that be like, just, I'm going to get up and take a shower today. That's all I'm going to do for myself, is just make sure I take a shower today. And for many grievers, that can feel like such a hard and difficult accomplishment. So sort of finding ways to engage in our lives like that is important. And then the last C is control. So loss can often impact our sense of control, right? So rebuilding it, even in small ways, can make a difference. So when we think about resilience after loss, we're not just talking about bouncing back. We're talking about honoring grief while helping people slowly reconnect with their strength, identity, and their purpose in life. So now let's talk a little bit about resilience and grief. So what does the research tell us about resilience and adaptation? So this is some of the key concepts when you do a literature search on resilience and grief that come up. So some of these we talked about already, so I won't spend much time, but I really want to hone in again on the importance of cognitive flexibility, meaning making, emotion regulation, social connection, acceptance of mortality, life experience, the dual process coping. So we talked about that earlier, that touch it, put it away, that going back and forth between touching that deep emotional pain and then totally putting it away and getting some restoration. This is a really key piece that can help people with their resilience in face of grief, and engagement in routine, which is what we just talked about. So how do you know that we can change or enhance our resilience? Well, I'm happy to tell you that our Stein Institute has developed a research of resilience intervention, and we've tested it, and it's evidence-based. So it's a manualized 3- and 6-week program that's designed to enhance the traits associated with resilience. It was developed here over 10 years ago, and we have studied it in multiple settings, including communities in California, Arizona, Chicago, and in the UK and Israel. And so sort of the high level is that we looked at the science and the research on resilience and what enhances resilience, and we put together a program. It's now a 6-week program. It started at 3. And here are the components that are part of it. And these are all things that are tied to resilience, right? So cognitive, affective, and behavioral exercises. And so week after week, we have the older adults sort of follow a manualized plan, which is led by a trained facilitator. And I want to show you a little bit about the results on that. So when we started this program, we had no idea if it would work. We developed something, we got funding for it, we tried it out. And I'm so happy to tell you, the results were great. We found decreased in perceived stress, decrease in depressive symptoms, decrease in loneliness, increase in wisdom scores, increase in resilience, and increase in self-compassion. And we've had three different studies published in peer-reviewed journals. So it really is such a delight to see this. And it's now licensed through UCSD and available for purchase to communities and people working with older adults. And so here's just some data on the first study that we published that showed that over time, people who were in the program, their resilience scores increased. And this one is a table from our first study as well that showed that perceived stress scores decreased. They started to go back up after the intervention ended, but we did see a decrease during the time of the intervention. So let's move to the final portion of my talk where we can sort of synthesize some of the things that I've told you at a high level and think about like the takeaways of what I want you to think about today. So what types of things do we know facilitate adaptation? Support, the dual process model, touch it, put it away, allowing ourselves space to touch those deep, painful emotions. So again, like touching all four corners of that awful, painful thing and then putting it away and then coming back to it and then putting it away. It's remembering that grief isn't linear and that grief is not something to be resolved, but something to be adapted to. And that if we can help find a way to regain routine, and in the beginning, that is so difficult. It's like climbing mountains to think about even getting into the shower, right? So of course, it will be difficult at first. I don't expect this to seem easy. But in time, if you can start regaining routine, just get back to that yoga class or sort of do the things that you used to like, even if it feels really hard, and engage in value-driven activities, so things that are meaningful to you. So things to consider if you're struggling with anticipatory loss. We want you to acknowledge the current grief. Remember, this is one of the most important things you can think about. Anticipation does not equal preparedness. So many people will say that when their loved one died, even though they had been, you know, terminally ill for years, nothing prepared them for the moment that their loved one died because they just weren't allowing themselves to face and confront the reality that their loved one was going to die. They were sort of like disconnecting from that reality. So time and anticipation does not equal preparedness. You want you to engage in present connection as much as you can and prioritize your well-being. So how do we help others? This is something I get all the time. My friend is grieving. Someone's grieving. I have no idea what to do. This is so uncomfortable. I don't know how to help them. First of all, normalize diverse grief responses is really what I want you to think about. And there's also no one single correct way to grieve. So don't judge other people's grieving and don't judge your own grieving. And prioritize presence over perfection. You don't have to get it right. Just show up. Just ask. If you can come by, sort of make those efforts. Of course, you want to follow your friends or family members' lead, but use mindful language. I can't tell you how often I hear from grievers that they were inadvertently hurt from what somebody said. So like staying away from things like, I once had somebody tell me that, you know, your brother's in a better place. And I just found that to like be so difficult and upsetting. People also say that like anything related to like, you should just move on. You should just, you know, get over it. Like saying things like, or even the types of words we use like death or dying or passed away, like certain terms might be activating to grievers too. So pay attention to the words and the language your griever's using. And be cautious not to say things that could be interpreted in a way that feels a little bit painful. Encourage re-engagement in daily life. Help your loved ones connect to their values. And also be attentive. Now you know about prolonged grief. So keep that on your radar if you see people struggling for periods of time. And I want to just wrap up with, there's a lot of resources on here. The good news is I'm going to have it posted on our website. But what's even more important is there are so many free resources for grievers. So that's the good news. There is not enough space on this slide for me to put them all. There are wonderful resources online. There are support groups. There are therapists. There are lots of options, meetup groups for you to consider if you're struggling and need some support. So with that, I want to wrap up with thanking. There's so many people to thank for the work that I've done, both as a grief therapist and also in my resilience work. But of course, I want to start with my director, Dr. Allison Moore, and my scientific director, Dr. Anthony Molina. I want to thank Sid Zizuk for supporting me and my journey of becoming a grief therapist, and Dr. Kathy Shear for training me. I want to thank Dr. Barton Palmer for all of his support he's given me, including the development of the resilience work that I've done, and the folks at Belmont Village for all that they've done in supporting the work that our resilience manual has brought to fruition. And of course, my team, Rebecca Daly, Paula Smith, and Sasha Weiss. So with that, I'd like to say thank you for your attention and your interest in this really meaningful and important work of grief and loss.
Thank you. Thank you, Danielle.
Yeah.
So one question that's come through already is, what is the average length of grieving before someone is thought to be in the prolonged grief state?
Okay. This is a great question, and it's complicated. It's not a straight line. When we look at prolonged grief disorder, we're looking at a number of things. Number one is time. So just because the DSM says 1 year doesn't mean we diagnose unilaterally at 1 year. So I'm going to be looking at the various components of the loss. So again, loss of a child. I'm never diagnosing prolonged grief at 1 year for the loss of a child. So in fact, it's very rare that I diagnose prolonged grief at 1 year ever, because for most people, it can take 1 to 2 years to really start to work through and adapt to a loss. But if we start to see people still grieving pretty intensely at 3 years, 4 years, then it's probably time to consider prolonged grief disorder as a diagnosis. And one of the things I want to be clear about is, like, people sometimes get concerned about this being a diagnosis, right? And so what I would say is, what's less important is that diagnosis, and more important is the access to care. So if you are struggling with those symptoms that look and feel similar to prolonged grief, prolonged grief disorder therapy would still be extremely helpful for anybody at any stage of their grieving, because of all the pieces that are built into the therapy. It's all about facilitating adaptation, which can happen at month six or year four.
Thank you. Where can we find the program in resilience in our area?
Ah, this is a great question. So on our website, we have information on our website about our resilience program. And I know I had to go through it fast. I had to speed up because I had so many slides. But our resilience manual is licensed. And if you're interested, you can send me an email and I'll set up a meeting and tell you more about it. And then we go through our innovations office on campus to do all of that work. But I'd be happy to meet with you and talk to you about it, because the more older adults that can get access to our program, the better.
Can you talk more about grief for people with family members with dementia, like how it's different and how to deal with it?
Yeah. So it's a little bit about what I was talking about with anticipatory grief and ambiguous grief. Like, those are the two key things that I see for grievers that are caregivers, and why people who are caregivers are more likely to develop prolonged grief, right? Because there is sort of this ambiguous grief that's happening and this anticipatory grief that's happening. So we are grieving like a long runway, right? A long runway of grief, which means years and years of pain and suffering and loss. But usually without the option for, like, the type of support we need, because many people don't maybe give the same support to somebody who is caregiving for someone with dementia like they would if you just lost your spouse to cancer. You're not getting, like, the food train and the support and people coming by and helping you. You're sort of on your own for a long period of time, navigating something that is a loss a day. You know, it's like every single day there's a new thing that you're having to adapt to. They can no longer recognize me anymore. And tomorrow it's like they can no longer, you know, get up and about on their own. It's like it's a constant barrage of loss after loss. And it can feel so overwhelming, which is why the loss is really so challenging and people don't feel ready when the loss actually happens.
Thank you. Another question is, you mentioned rigidity and the personality of an individual at risk for being a prolonged griever. How can a person address this ahead of time?
Yes. So this is a tricky one. A great therapist will help you with this. But it's a really difficult one to do on your own because you might not realize that you're being rigid. So let me give you some examples. Some of the common things I see with rigid thinking, and I would say that I was guilty of this too. So no judgment here, but our rigid thinking can be seeing the loss in a really narrow lens. So I do a lot of work with suicide loss survivors because my loss is suicide. And so we can get very focused on perhaps the story that it was my fault. It was my fault. It was my fault. And so we can start to see that through this very narrow lens. And a good grief therapist or a good friend or just a good therapist will sort of help you look at that thing through a more wider lens perspective, right? Because like, let's sort of dial that back. How much of that was really your fault? Let's like go underneath it, because many of us like believe these really rigid thoughts that oftentimes aren't real. They're just the story we're telling ourselves. So again, another example would be when mothers that I work with who've lost a child tell themselves that they can't let go of their grief because their grief is what ties them to their child. And they are convinced of that. And what I know as a grief therapist is that is actually not true. What that pain and suffering does, it doesn't tie us to our child. It ties us internally to suffering. So whenever I ask my clients, well, let's think about that. Like when you are suffering most intensely, how connected do you feel to your child? They'll be like, actually, I don't feel connected at all. In those moments, I'm suffering. I am feeling so awful. It is such an inside job. It's actually like very almost self-centered because it's so, I'm so pained. And I'll say, okay, so when is it that you do feel the most connected? And they'll be like, oh, you know, when I was thinking about them yesterday and like the memories of like when I went by their baseball field and I was just thinking about how sweet it was to watch them hit that home run. I'd be like, see, the suffering isn't what connects us to our loved one. And in fact, when we can get that suffering more under control and it becomes, you know, like more manageable, it opens up this whole world of connection that we didn't have. So there's sort of that rigid thought that I can't let go of the grief because what would it, you know, it would make me let go of my loved one, which actually is the opposite, which is if I could reduce this suffering some, it would open up my connection to my loved one.
Another question, is it all right to avoid thinking about and discussing the difficult times of the illness at a time near the death? I think that's the question.
Can you say it again?
Is it all right to avoid thinking about and discussing the difficult times of the illness and time near death? That's it, I guess. So my understanding of the question is it all right to not think about or talk about the hard stuff that occurred near the time of death?
So what I believe, there is no one size fits all. Okay, so everybody has their own path of grieving and getting to a place of adaptation. So I don't want to try to say that the way that anybody's doing something is wrong. But I do want you to think about one really important point, which is that avoidance maintains pain. So if there are things that we are actively trying to avoid, or there are things that we are trying to like keep our thoughts away from, they're likely keeping us stuck. So the idea in prolonged grief disorder therapy is to be able to narrate those things and to be able to sort of take the unthinkable and make them thinkable. So the more that we can talk about it and process it, we can take sort of the sting out of it. And then we can make it more manageable, more thinkable, which then sort of relieves this like sting that anytime we think about it, it like this knife hits us, right? So what I would say is I might consider sort of confronting that a little bit and thinking about it from like a, how can I, it's almost like exposure therapy, right? So we know about exposure therapy, like exposing ourselves to very painful things, maybe like in very small doses, exposing ourselves to that painful thing, tolerating it, and then putting it away and see if that helps.
Any tips for dealing with triggers to grief to avoid spiraling?
This is another really difficult one. And it's not one size fits all again. What I would say is like, if the triggers or the things that are activating you are genuinely getting in the way of your functioning, that's concerning. If the triggers are just painful, that's a different thing, right? So what we want to do, like in a perfect world, what we want you to do is, let's say I feel triggered every time I drive by a hospital where my loved one died, right? Like that could be a trigger for me, or some, there could be something else, right? What we want to do is help people be able to tolerate those feelings that come up, not avoid them, not get rid of them, tolerate them, learn to understand them and like sit with them, live with them, tolerate it for a second. If it's getting in the way of your functioning, that's another story. So let's just say it's you're at work and the triggers are coming up and it's really difficult to get your job done. That is probably when you need to seek some help and get some support, because those sort of intrusive thoughts and those triggers that make it difficult to function, at least as we sort of move on in our grief journey, that's when it can become challenging. But for the most part, I say lean into the pain that comes up from those triggers, lean into it a little bit, tolerate it. Like I said, dual process, tolerate it for a minute and then totally put it away. I've told people before, like I tell people to do a 10 minute rule. If there's anything that's really difficult, let's just say it's a photo of someone, it's so painful, I can't look at it. I'll say, try to sit with the pain of it for 10 minutes. That's it. Now we don't start with 10 minutes, start with 1 minute, then put it away. Okay, I did that. Then let's go up to 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And if we can get to a place where we can tolerate it for 10 minutes, it is transformative. It really changes our ability to understand it and to be able to live with it. Not get rid of it, live with it.
Thank you. There's a lot of questions about, I think, both the resilience program as well as resources for grief in not only older people, but younger people. Anything more about that?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, there's not enough resources for children has been my experience in grief. And in fact, I know very few trained grief therapists that are focused on children. This has been a really difficult thing in our field, unfortunately. So that one is challenging. But there are online resources now that we didn't have, you know, say 5-10 years ago. Now, there are also people who specialize in working with older adults who are grieving. So there's options there too. And we're going to place on our website, I have a bunch of resources with links that people can click on that will take them to free services.
And also there were questions about the resilience program and is it available to who exactly? And I guess they can go to our website and see and ask more questions if you
need. Yeah, we are very open to who wants to utilize it. I mean, I would say that the first step is always get in touch with me and I'll meet with you one-on-one. And part of getting the manual and purchasing it is that I do all the training. So I will train you in how to use the manual and I will support you through your journey of implementing it. It's been designed to be used with older adults. And we have recently adapted it to be used specifically for caregivers. And we just put in a grant not that long ago, fingers crossed, to see for caregivers to see if this intervention helps them too. But I would say start with contacting me. I'd love to talk to you about it.
Well, this has been a terrific session. Thank you so much, Danielle. There is many more questions. I'm sorry we could not get to, but you know how to reach us. And people are highly interested. We're so glad that you're here today and telling us about your important work and this important topic. So reminder that all our past newsletters, lectures, and updates on ongoing research and training programs are also available on our website, which again is aging.ucsd.edu. And you can donate in support of our work there. And again, thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you at other programs that we have ongoing throughout the year. And we have one final slide.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to be here today.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.